Welcome to a Tuesday. Welcome to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Washington State Representative Matt Manweller is now on leave from Central Washington University while they investigate alleged inappropriate conduct. Celebrity chef Mario Batali is on leave from his restaurants and his TV show The Chew after five women accused him of harassment. That's just the latest couple. Every week, more men are being held accountable. Do women need to change their approach as well? My first guest is Northwestern University Communications Professor Laura Kipnis, author of the book Unwanted Advances, Sexual Paranoia Comes to Campus. Welcome, Laura.
Hi.
You've said that some women don't realize the power they have when they're being harassed. Will you start by explaining the Gretchen Carlson example?
Yes, I reviewed Gretchen Carlson's book in the New York Review of Books, which is about sexual harassment, and doesn't really talk about her own situation at Fox, but all the women who wrote to her after she went public with her case. And, you know, it's just endemic, and I think that's what this moment is teaching us, that, you know, there's so much of this stuff that's going on behind the scenes. And I think now the conversation is shifting to how do we analyze this, you know, not just as an issue about sex, but also about work and women's advancement in the workplace and the things that have been impeding us. And that makes it an issue about equality. So I've tried to link this really to the history of feminism and feminist struggles about both equity, you know, in jobs in the workplace, but also autonomy over our own bodies, meaning, you know, we're not public property. People don't get to just grope us when they feel like it, whether that's in a joking fashion or not. So, you know, I think we're all figuring out how to strategize about these situations that have been going on, you know, sub rosa, behind the scenes.
Yes, and that. Thank you for the context there. In that context, you described Gretchen Carlson, the Fox anchor. She described one incident she had, and you. It sounded like you wanted to say, feel the power that you do have. Don't cower.
Yeah, and it's. I mean, obviously, it's not up to women alone to contest this vast, you know, swamp of you know, male misconduct. But I also think that the problem is women feel like if we only have institutional solutions, we're impeded from standing up for ourselves in those situations. And I've written about, you know, the campus situation where this recourse to institutional solutions, you know, with Title IX and with campus administrators, I think women forget that men aren't all powerful and, you know, become overly frozen and intimidated and impeded in these situations. And I think that a lot of this behavior is actually not just about power, it's actually pathetic. It's like men trying to assert a sort of assurance and power that they don't actually have, and we don't need to believe them and take them at their word. I think they're using sex as a way to feel empowered, or sexual talk or sexual commands, and, you know, we don't have to buy into that.
Also with us is Ijeoma Oluo, a Seattle writer and the editor-at-large of The Establishment. Her new book is So You Want to Talk About Race. Welcome back, Ijeoma. How do you feel about the idea of women having power beyond an institutional solution, maybe more power than they realize in their interactions in the workplace?
You know, I think it's important that we look at both internal liberation and external liberation, but that we don't act as if those two are in competition. You know, the internal liberation is kind of freeing yourself from that internalized patriarchy. We all live in this system, which means that we all kind of uphold it to some degree and we're trapped in it to some degree. But I think it is really important to remember that some of us have limited agency as to whether or not we participate in the system. Now, this does not mean that all women are powerless, but I do think that it's really important that we're careful when we have these conversations to always be cognizant of who has the ultimate responsibility in taking on and dismantling these systems. And it's going to be the people who benefit from it and the people who risk the least by challenging it. And those are men in a system of patriarchy. I think that self-empowerment is really important, and we definitely do need to be talking to each other with love and generosity about the ways in which maybe we have been conditioned to think less of ourselves and to play a role in this system that we may not even know that we're playing. But at the same time, I think we have to be, you know, very realistic about the risks that many women and femmes face when they take on the system and know that, you know, for some people, it will not be possible, that you will lose your job, your ability to feed your kids, that you will lose your ability to actually continue to speak up when you're not in that environment anymore. And I think we have to do that balance. We do the work together as women and femmes to talk about our own internal liberation, at least knowing what is and isn't okay. But then also we have to constantly keep the pressure and the spotlight and the responsibility that men have to undo the system itself, because they do have the most power there to either uphold or destroy that system.
Well, let's take one example, because there's such a range of behavior. There's physical attack on one end. Dr. Kipnis, Professor Kipnis, you recounted the story of this Fox anchor, Gretchen Carlson, being with a cameraman, and you were wondering, why is it that she didn't just tell him to shut up? What's that about?
Yeah, it was a controversial point that I raised. She was alone in a car. She was a young reporter for a TV station with a cameraman who started talking about, like, getting off on putting this microphone on her and talking about sex throughout the car ride back to the office. And she said that she was so fearful that she was trembling throughout the trip, that she wondered if she should jump out of the car, that when she got back to the office, she was still trembling in terror. And I said that, you know, this is like, you know, it becomes the equivalent of the master stick. If all a man has to do is talk about sex, for a woman to tremble and cower, and then we have to be able to make some distinctions in situations like that between force and power. And he wasn't her boss. He was a peer. So he hadn't made any explicit threats. So for her to respond to bringing up sex as if it were in itself a threat, I thought was an overreaction. And so I just think that we have to be capable of making of these distinctions. And I completely agree with everything that my co-panelist just said. I really completely agree that it's not just on women, but I think there is a sort of emphasis that if we emphasize the risk and the possible consequences, that we will be more impeded in trying to live in an empowered way than otherwise. But it's true, there realistically are and can be consequences for acting assertively.
You know, I would definitely say that I do like read what happened in that car with Gretchen as a threat. It's not just that someone's talking about sex around that person. It's someone chose when they were in a enclosed environment and had the power of, you know, a vehicle and that someone could not escape to bring up something that intimate without permission. That was an aggressive move, that was aimed at showing that he had power over her. And I do think that those sorts of things are meant to be threats and are threats. It's meant to show women that they have so little respect for them and that they can't do anything about it. What are you going to do? I'm driving the car. What are you going to do? You're stuck in a closed space with me. And it really is meant to intimidate. My teenage son was actually talking the other day about how there's this kid who likes to wander up and down the halls and then sit right next to a girl in class and then talk to other boys graphically about sex. He's doing this not because he and his buddies like sex. He's doing it because he's in an environment where this girl can't just walk up and leave, and she has to hear this. And it is a threat, and it's an intimidation, and it's an attack in a way. And I do think that we need to look at it because it's all part of the continuum. And I don't think it's an overreaction, because these things do escalate. These things do play into the overall thought of women as property. And if you're feeling low and if you're feeling powerless, all you have to do is intimidate the nearest woman next to you and you feel like you're on top of the world. So I do think that we need to look at that. In fact, I do think that's shocking, and I would be upset and I probably would feel very unsafe, especially as someone who has, you know, lived through sexual assault. It would feel incredibly unsafe in that situation. And I think for a lot of women would feel the same way. And I think that we definitely need to, you know, I think we need to be more angry about what's been happening and not less.
Laura?
Well, I hear that. And I guess what I would say is that perhaps it was a threat, which doesn't mean that you have to be intimidated by it. I mean, here's, you know, the sorry fact is that there is a certain amount of aggression in the world in all spheres, sexual, professional, et cetera. And I think that if we as women aren't able to some degree, deal with that. There aren't always going to be institutional remedies. And I don't think that we're going to, through institutional means, regulate or eliminate all the aggression in the world. So becoming threatened in a situation where, or feeling, you know, subjectively threatened in a situation where there isn't any actual threat, I think gives more power to the person wielding that tactic.
Well, let's take it out then away from this one example. There's so much we don't know about tone and body language and implication.
Sure.
But what in a bigger picture, Professor, what's another example of how you would like women to carry themselves or to think of their options and their power differently in the world as we're all rethinking these issues? Can you give us one other important example?
Well, when I was in my 20s, I took self-defense classes. I mean, you know, I too am a woman and am afraid walking down the street and grew up in Chicago and, you know, that sort of thing. And in writing about the campus situation and unwanted advances, I actually think if we're going to do sexual assault training, which is now mandatory on campuses, that we include self-defense training for women. And I understand that it's men who should change their behavior and the culture that should change. But, you know, just in case that doesn't happen overnight, I really think teaching women that you can stand up for yourself and, if required, to push back physically really changes your own subjectivity. I mean, that was my own experience. You feel more confident on the street, you know, or in private life situations. So that's a suggestion that I would make.
How do you react to that, Ijeoma? It could take away some of this implied threat when a woman feels physically able to take care of herself, self-defense classes.
You know, I would say that I think that kind of is a erroneous look at what sexual assault and sexual harassment actually looks like in our society. I think a lot of times that kind of falls into the whole, oh, you're probably going to be attacked by like someone in an alley. And yeah, we are scared walking alone at night. But the truth is if you are going to be assaulted, it's chances are it's someone you know, someone you trust.
But why can't you fight back against someone you know? I mean, that's actually the problem is women don't fight back against people they know.
Well, I mean, the problem is that people are sexually assaulting people. That's the problem. The problem is not how people fight back or not. There are many ways in which people are coerced and prevented from fighting back. And I think that part of the harm we do to a lot of women is we say, what did you do to stop it? When the truth is that the question should begin and end with, why did a man feel entitled to the body of a woman? Why did a man not seek consent? I don't think that we should, if we continue to arm and it's let the strongest person win, someone is always going to lose that battle. And instead, we need to start and stop with issues of consent and respect for people and their bodies and their autonomy. And I think that when we start going in with, you know, well, have you trained? What if you freeze? Some people just freeze. Some people,
sure,
that's what they do. And then they
but
carry
that's
why that
training
guilt.
Helps.
They
not
carry,
to freeze.
Well, no, because sometimes they've shown that people won't. Some people don't have the personality to ever fight, no matter how much training they have. And then they carry for the rest of their life the feeling that maybe they brought this on themselves and they should have fought harder. And that stuff, that ends up seeping into our criminal courts. They constantly, you know, when you're asked questions, well, what did you do to fight back? When the question should start with, did this person get your consent, your enthusiastic consent? No, that's a violation. And that we can start not just from a sort of how are we punishing these? How are we looking at these things? But also how are we teaching young men? How are we, you know, structuring our schools? How are we structuring our systems? I don't believe that it is endemic in male nature to violate the consent of women. I do believe that this is taught and we can unteach it. And I think that when we give these outs as to how hard women fight, there's only so much fighting we can
do
in society, fighting our boss, fighting
okay.
man.
Laura, I'd like to hear your reaction to that.
Yeah, you misunderstand me because, once again, it's not an either-or, and it's not taking the onus off men. It's saying that, you know, to take the approach that you are, I think, is to kind of like reinscribe this sort of passivity, like we have to wait for men to change before we do something. And so what about the interim? I mean, I, you know, as a teacher, am concerned that in the interim, until the day when every man gets the message to stop assaulting women, that women are sort of in the position of not being taught to contest it, because a certain strand of feminist thinking, not mine, and I am a feminist, a certain strand of feminist thinking takes a sort of, I think, somewhat passive approach. So that's what I'm trying to contest. I think that you're right. I agree with what you said initially, that there is an inscribed kind of passivity and socialization for women to not stand up for ourselves. And that doesn't mean that's the only solution, and I would be an idiot if I said that, but it's among a range of things we can be talking about at this moment.
Are we talking about whether the idea of women, in this case, taking self-defense classes, is sending a harmful message? Is that what you're saying? Because I hear both of you saying this is not either or. You know, stand up for yourself, and it's wrong. Your body is yours. Why is that? Why is there a dispute between those two ideas?
I would say that, you know, I say that women and femmes can do whatever they need to feel safer. And if that means a self-defense class, if that means a feminist studies class, if, you know, if that means traveling in groups, do that. But I also think that continuously when we have these systemic issues, we always look at the oppressed and say, let's add to your burden. Not only are you living with this, not only are you navigating this, but let's add to the burden of things that you have to do to try and lift that burden that you did not place on yourself. And I think that it is incredibly important. And I don't think it's passive to say that women should not have to take self-defense classes. I don't think it's passive to say that the buck starts and stops with men deciding to violate the consent of women. I think that it is incredibly aggressive and progressive to say that, no, when we penalize, when we talk about this, when it comes down to looking at each individual situation, that we are going to say that this is 100% on the people who are doing these actions and on society that enables those actions. It does not mean that women can't take self-defense classes, but when we start looking at it as a, you know, well, women can do this because then they'll be like less susceptible to things, the truth is that, you know, the evidence doesn't really bear that out. The statistics don't bear that out.
That's okay. Completely wrong. The evidence completely bears out that women resisting have a better chance of avoiding being raped. And that sexual self-defense classes aid in women feeling empowered. And I can say personally that it helped me quite a lot. And I think it infiltrates into your own thinking about yourself and how you move through the world. So, I mean, it's, you know, it is about having to live in the real world. And, you know, that's where I live.
Okay, that's our time for today, as we all are watching the Me Too, the allegations, and any cultural change that might come from this. That's what we're talking about with Laura Kipnis, professor at Northwestern University, author of the book Unwanted Advances, Sexual Paranoia Comes to Campus. Thank you, Laura.
Thanks.
And Ijeoma Oluo is a Seattle writer, editor-at-large of The Establishment, and we'll be talking soon about her next book coming out next month. It's called So You Want to Talk About Race. Thanks for talking about this with us today, Ijeoma.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. We'll be right back with a change in the law regarding short-term rentals in this town. Here's the day's news on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Seattle is going to regulate short-term rentals like Airbnb. The city council signed off on it yesterday. KUOW's Paige Browning in from the newsroom now. Hi, Paige.
Hey, Bill.
What is the big idea here?
So this is really about housing. Seattle's housing stock is already low, and city officials think the practice of converting permanent housing into short-term rentals is taking homes out of the housing market. So the idea is to limit how many vacation rentals a property owner can operate. That way, owners of, say, an apartment building can't just turn over dozens of apartments into Airbnbs. And the city council has heard from a lot of people concerned about their buildings basically being turned into hotels because of this industry. Actually, Belltown condo owner Antoinette Freeman, she testified at the council meeting yesterday.
Our entire block condominium has 245 residential units. The 60-plus vacation rentals create a steady influx of large groups of strangers entering and exiting at all times of the day and night.
And she and many other people have told the council it's also an issue of safety when tourists are coming in through the building every day and night.
Paige, do we know that short-term rentals threaten affordability?
Well, the city does not have accurate numbers on this, and the city admits that. One nonprofit community group, Puget Sound Sage, says the city has lost 2,000 homes to Airbnb. City officials estimate they'll bring back 300 to 700 of these homes by implementing the new regulations. But like I said, there are no exact numbers. Airbnb doesn't share all of its stats on housing or units.
Okay, so there's been debate about how to regulate, whether and how to regulate short-term rentals. So what is actually changing?
The ordinance sets a cap on the number of rental units that a person can operate. So under the rules, the cap is 2 units for most rental hosts. They'll be allowed to open a third rental after 1 year. And actually, there will be no cap for rental hosts in the downtown core as long as they were already operating Airbnbs by this year.
Why no cap in the downtown core?
Well, in short, it's because that's the neighborhood where the tourism is already the biggest. Entertainment industry, hotel industry, nightlife. Keep the Airbnbs strong there.
And what are some people saying about this? We heard one woman earlier giving her point of view. What else are you hearing?
Well, Airbnb and the hotel industry says they support the new rules. In fact, Airbnb says this is a landmark win for their hosts and their platform and could be a model regulation for other cities. There are some individuals who operate Airbnbs and other short-term rentals that don't love the regulations because they'll have to shut some down. When they're limited to only 2, they will have to shut some down in the near future.
We'll follow the implementation and the consequences intended and not. Paige Browning from KUOW's newsroom, thank you for this.
Thank you, Bill.
It's The Record on KUOW. Back in just a moment with some improvisation. Don't go away. It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. I'm not afraid to speak in public. I talk into this microphone every day. I did stand-up comedy in a hostel bar in Roseburg, Oregon. They did not find me funny. But improv theater? No. I have never done improv. I'm brave. I'm not crazy. Improvisational theater is invented in the moment while the audience is watching and waiting. Improv is a proving ground. It's given us some of our favorite entertainers. It's also very American, as I learned in the new book, Improv Nation, How We Made a Great American Art. The author is Sam Wasson. He has done improv. Welcome, Sam.
Hi, thank you.
Thanks for coming. First of all, improv is more than just improvising within a sketch. Will you define improv?
Well, I think a good way to do it is I would say improv is jumping into the unknown with another person. And the other person is an important part of this because when
sounds like life.
It is. It is. And finally, the most enlightened improvisers have made that connection and they live life as if it were an improv. That's absolutely right.
So jumping in into the unknown with another person.
So the reason why the other person, so the unknown part is pretty intuitive. Mm-hmm. You don't know what's going to happen next is the unknown, and that's improvisation. But the other person part is crucial because if it's just you, you can then fall back on your own personal riffs, what you know about yourself, your own consciousness. And that doesn't take you into the unconsciousness, which is the unknown, which is where you want to be. It requires another person to throw you off your own game. So the purest improvisation is more than one person.
Into the unconscious. This is going to get psychological, too.
I like to go there.
Good. While we're on kind of the history and the definition here, I had assumed that improv is ancient and universal. I mean, before there was paper and writing, we were entertaining each other spontaneously. How can this be an American art form?
Well, I'm sure that's true. I'm sure people were just getting up. People have been getting up and having a good time as long as there have been people.
Yes.
But it was not codified. It was not said officially that this is This is a distinct school of theater until Viola Spolin, who founded this work in Chicago in the 20s and 30s, came out and said, okay, we're doing something different here. There's a completely new rule book. And then it was her son, Paul Sills, who brought it into the Compass Theater.
And Viola didn't just spontaneously found a theater troupe. Will you tell the brief story of how this happened?
No, this did not start out as theater. I mean, the story of improvisation is itself improvised. So yes, this did not begin as improvisational theater. Viola Spolin was a social worker, and she specialized in games and in drama. And one of the ways that she got children to relate to each other was by creating these problems. That's what she called them. And they were improvisational games. And by playing these games, by diving into these problems, children began to break through their discomfort, their self-consciousness. And what makes this so American is that Viola was teaching children at Hull House. These were immigrant children of different races, different classes. They spoke different languages and came from different cultures and often didn't have the means to communicate with each other anyway. But when Viola threw them into the unknown together, they could help each other come out of it. And that, I think, is what America is when it's America.
Thrown into the unknown. Yeah. Yes, yes.
We're a work in progress, right?
You find this very American in terms of our democracy, you can think of the improvisational jazz,
and
which
every
is American.
Every voice comes into improvisation. I mean, if you think about an improvisational theater, an improvisational experience, even the audience is calling back at you, telling you what they want. You don't have that in the legit stage.
That's true. That is true. The audience is part of the show. Your first chapter is called We the Jews. What is Jewish about improv?
Well, I think like all comedy, it's about being marginalized, marginal groups. The Jews were more marginalized then in America than they were now. So they were one.
Starting at about 1940?
Starting at 1940 or 50. And then my second chapter is the punks. You're thinking about Bill Murray. You're thinking about Belushi. And then we have the nerds, Colbert and Carell. Now, these groups started on the margin and then gradually, by way of comedy, actually became part of the mainstream. So much so now that we don't even think of nerd as pejorative anymore. People, they say nerd with pride.
Yes.
But these guys, they started out when nerd was almost a bad word.
And why is marginalized important in theater and comedy?
In comedy, it's important because comedy is about not having power. And if you think about, you've got to be angry. You've got to be...
Why do you have to be angry?
Well, because comedy...
You have to be funny. Why do you have to be angry?
Well, because comedy is a problem. Comedy is saying, this is not right. That's why you're laughing. You're laughing at a discrepancy between what should be and what is. And that's often the province of someone who's unempowered.
Yeah, okay.
You're complaining about something.
Yes.
Yeah, you know?
If everything was hunky-dory, exactly. It's not interesting.
No
certainly not funny.
Exactly. And no rage. Therefore, no rage.
No rage.
Yeah.
It's interesting we're talking about rage because the most famous thing about improv is the idea of yes and. Where's the rage in that?
Well, it's not there. And that's why this work is so healing, especially to comedians who come in with so much rage. And that's why that's why this book ends up being a very happy story for a lot of people who start out not being happy. Because when you play with people and you support each other and you take care of each other and you yes and each other, it becomes very hard to sustain that level of anger. And that's why this work in the end can be so healing.
Well, how did yes and become the rule? Because you could also say there's comedy in conflict. You got to have conflict.
Well, no, it's an important distinction to make. Yes and isn't saying don't have conflict.
Uh-huh.
You can disagree with someone that you're improvising with, but what you can't do is undermine their reality. If they say, I love your blue jacket, you can't say, this is a red jacket.
It's a dead end.
It's an absolute dead end. And where does that scene go from there?
Yeah.
So you have to yes and their reality, which doesn't mean you have to agree with them.
You know what? There's a lot of undermining each other's realities these days. It doesn't seem like America's doing a lot of yes and.
I would agree with you.
We are a bad improv.
I would agree with you. And we have a bad improviser in chief, I would say. Yes, absolutely. We need to be a more improvisational country. Absolutely. And when we are, we're really improvising. And that's one of the messagey things about this book. That's one of the things that I think is nobler about this book and makes it more than just art and show business, is that in here is really a way to live life.
Yeah, this is not just aside, an observation to you. You think that improv is what America has been doing well, and that's part of who we are?
I think when it's good, we're improvising. Yeah. Absolutely.
Again, the book is Improv Nation, How We Made a Great American Art, and the author is Sam Wasson. I promised some psychology. You were picking up on the unconscious and, you know, being thrown into the unknown. You said improv is like therapy.
Yeah.
Right? How is that true for you?
Well, I felt good for the most part when I was improvising. I mean, I'm an anxious person. A lot of us are anxious people.
How does an anxious person go
get
out
to improv?
Get into improv?
Because
the scariest thing, like I told you at the top, I do things that other people think is scary. Improv is another planet of scary.
It is
me.
Scary, and I didn't quite get over it. But you find moments when you're improvising. I mean, there are certain moments when you're improvising when no one does really catch you, and you fall on your face, and it is as horrible as it sounds. Especially if you're like me and you're not really that good. But there are, on the other hand, moments where somebody does catch you. And when you feel enough of that on stage, you begin to think, just like you said at the beginning of the show, wait, the only difference between stage and life is a platform a couple inches off the ground. If I can apply what I'm doing here to real life off stage, maybe if I do leap, someone will catch me if I'm improvising with somebody who also understands how to do this. So in time, it does build up, I hate to say it, your confidence.
You said that you're not that great at it. You're very self-deprecating, but you've interviewed a lot of famous improvisers. Did you hear that story? Does a story stand out of someone telling you how improv changed their approach to
everyone,
the rest of life?
Everyone.
Tell me a story.
Every single one. And the other thing that's so incredible about it is that, and I was talking about this with Kelly Leonard at Second City, that it's hard to think of an improviser who's not a good person.
Whereas, really?
Whereas in your field of stand-up, you have to be a bad person. In fact, I want to see a bad person when I go see stand-up. I mean, I want to see someone full of rage, consumed, angry, unhappy with... I mean, I think of stand-up comedians as the great protesters.
That's why I wasn't a better stand-up comedian. I'm too happy.
You're too nice.
I'm at peace.
Well, see, maybe you are an improviser.
Ah.
Maybe you're an improviser.
Okay. So tell me, does a story come to mind of somebody... improv changed my life?
Well, Mike Nichols was one of those guys.
Mike Nichols is a granddaddy of comedy and theater and sketch and movies. Oh my gosh. And improv too. He started out.
Yes. He is really he really is the grandfather of improvisational comedy with Elaine May.
And Nichols and May, may have heard of.
Exactly. And Nichols started out a Jewish refugee. He fled Nazi Germany when he was 8. And he had good reason to be very, very angry. And not trustful of people, and always wary, obviously. He lived in fear. And it was only through improvising with Elaine that he really started to feel, wait a second, human beings are not all Nazis. They're not all bad. They're not all out to get me. Maybe I can leap with Elaine and gradually Barbara Harris and Eugene Trubnik and everyone else in his ensemble. And it actually made Mike... It was one of the things that softened Mike.
Okay, Mike Nichols, Elaine May, those are legends of the theater and of comedy. And there are so many in this book. Obviously, you've already mentioned Bill Murray and Belushi, and more recently, Colbert and Carell. We have Saturday Night Live and Second City. I mean, the celestial pantheon, right? So here's my question. If improv is so great, how come people go from improv to sketch or to movies, to other things?
Oh.
They go to written form.
Oh, why would they leave theater?
It's like, oh yeah, I did improv back when I was a nobody. So what's so great about improv? Why isn't improv the ultimate entertainment experience? We seem to prefer sketch comedy in this country.
Well, improv, if you go to see an improv show, it could be awful.
Yes.
So that becomes a very hard thing to monetize and sell. But a sketch, you can rehearse. You can perfect it. So by the time it's ready for the world, you have something you can feel confident saying, okay, enjoy this. And in fact, most of what Second City is. Most of the Second City shows start out as improvisations, which are refined over time and over time. And so by the time you finally get to a Second City show, you're seeing more of a diamond.
So then what's better, a fantastic Key and Peele, you know, or SNL sketch, or an improv show live where the highs are high and the lows are low?
For me, I've gone higher in an improv show when it works because you're finally dealing with some ineffable metaphysical thing, which is how did this all happen? And that's just a level of human experience that straight drama doesn't necessarily get to.
You write about the improv theater that happened the night after JFK was assassinated. Was it funny?
No. Yeah. And that's okay. It was angry. The story was Del Close was on stage taking suggestions.
Another legend of improv.
That's right. And one of the suggestions that night was the assassination. And why shouldn't it be? That's what everyone was living. And Del Close shot back something angry at the audience, which is not a technique that a lot of people would feel comfortable with today. But it was Del being true in the moment. And that seems to me like a healthy interaction. So that's one of the things that improvisational theater can give us, is absolute conversation amongst, like I mentioned earlier, the audience and the players. We are talking back to each other live in the moment.
Well, let's talk about the downsides of being true in the moment. Del Close sounds like kind of a jerk to me. And does improv mean saying the first thing that comes to your mind? And what if that's offensive?
Well, Del was actually, ironically, one of the purveyors of a thing called slow improv. Now, he came to this later than the Kennedy assassination. So it took him a lot of, figuring this out before he came to the idea of slow improv, which is, you know, second thought, best thought, third thought, best thought, that it's not necessarily about speed. It's about taking your time. A lot of improvisers, they can fall into the trap of just being fast, thinking fast is good. But Del later on said, wait a second, slow down. And I really think slow improv is really exciting because it also lets in an emotional moment that you don't always get when you're doing fast, shticky, jokey improv.
But so, then aren't you censoring yourself as well, for better or for worse?
You could absolutely make that argument, but you could also be saying you are playing that character who has the capacity to think.
Yeah.
And why wouldn't he be thinking at that particular moment, just as a real person would be going through their first, second, or third thought?
I ask because I enjoy watching improv, but I have been in audiences where, and I understand, you're trying to get a laugh in that moment. Sometimes what people's reaction is to punch down, to say, if you're going to say the quick thing, you're probably going to say the obvious thing, which means you're probably talking and babbling in stereotypes and cheap laughs.
Can be bad.
Did you find that? That's true about improv,
yeah? Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. And the same goes for the audience members. I mean, how many times have an improviser gotten, stripper? How many, porn star? How many times? I mean, so yes, that goes both ways.
But should you never lecture an audience? Should you never say, what's wrong with you with that suggestion?
I think there's no nevers. I think that's the beauty of this thing, because once you put rules on it, you're not in the unknown.
I ask because, we keep seeing men lose their jobs for being unfiltered. And I don't know, maybe we need more improv skills at work. I know a guy who taught a colleague taught a workshop called Improv in the Workplace.
Yes.
It's like maybe we need to be better at improv and have better instincts for what's the right thing
to say.
Well,
it's applicable to everything. It's applicable to art, obviously, that's what we're talking about. It's applicable to psychology, which we touched on. It's applicable anywhere there are groups of people, because the fundamental thing that Yes And teaches you is just how to be good and how to recognize the other person that's sitting across from you. So wherever there's another person, improv is a healthy, nutritious, nurturing skill to have.
Yeah, it's not just people saying the wrong thing. I hear straight white male comedians especially complaining that, oh, I can't joke anymore. Who's the person who doesn't do college? Jerry Seinfeld doesn't do college campuses.
He doesn't. I'm so down on my stand-up having been.
Yeah, well, I know. You're in a rarefied world.
Yeah.
But, you know, the idea that, oh, I can't joke about race, I can't joke about sexual violence against women, you know, I should be able to joke about anything I want. Is there, you know, how is minimizing people, which sometimes happens, how is that good for our democratic back and forth?
Minimizing people? Well, I don't think anything should be off limits as a joke. Nothing.
You would joke about anything.
Oh, absolutely. Because you never know who's going to find what funny. You know, you might be insulted by something I think totally benign, and vice versa. So when you're going out there and looking at your audience and everybody is coming in with their own stories, the minute you start saying one thing is appropriate or inappropriate, you could find that you're closing yourself off to your entire audience. And just as improvisers have to be free to say anything, audience members are also free to say anything that they want. It's a conversation.
But the ultimate would be if the people, powerful people, you know, white guys like us, that if it was hilarious and uplifting at the same time, right?
I think when you're saying has to be, you're putting us into the known, and we have to go out into the unknown. That's the only place that we're going to transcend what we already know and discover what's new.
We have to go into the unknown. That's Sam Wasson, who's going to be at Jet City Improv in Seattle's University District. That's at 7:30. And you're going to be talking with the Jet City Improv founder, Andrew McMasters.
Right.
Yeah. Who knows what you're going to come up with?
We don't know. This is improv.
Improv Nation is the name of the book. And the subtitle is How We Made a Great American Art. Sam, thanks for this.
Thank you so much.
KUOW is The Record. Back in a moment. KUOW is The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in today. Last month, the Seattle Times reported a story from Southwest Washington about how immigrant neighbors were disappearing from a county that voted for Donald Trump. The reporter, Nina Shapiro, told us how neighbors were reacting.
You know, I talked to one employer who said it's like a storm. It's like, you know, ICE will come in one minute and take someone, and they're gone, and there's no warning. So there's just this sense like someone could disappear at any moment.
Well, last week, Nina got word that one of the undocumented immigrants in her story, Baltazar Aburto Gutierrez, had been arrested by federal immigration authorities. When the ICE agents picked him up, they reportedly told him, "You're the one from the newspaper." Gutierrez is awaiting a hearing at the Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma, and Nina Shapiro is here to talk with us again. Nina, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be here.
The man you interviewed was granted anonymity in your story. How did ICE find him?
Well, this was sort of unusual circumstances in that I was interviewing him about his longtime girlfriend's arrest. So ICE was familiar with her case. She was arrested in a very unusual way. She was selling a homemade pinata online. Someone answered the ad, supposedly interested in the pinata, when she went to meet this person, two ICE agents were waiting for her. And I also named who that person was. She's now in Mexico. So it's very clear what this case was. As well, ICE agents actually met this gentleman at the time because the agents walked their kids back to him to deliver them to him to take care of them while she was detained.
How are this man's children doing? What do we know about them?
They're in Mexico with their mom, and as far as I know, they're doing well.
ICE did some detective work. Why is it so rare? Why does that never happen?
I can't answer that. I think generally there is an understanding that the newspaper plays a role of providing information. We're a free press. Just like law enforcement doesn't go after reporters, generally speaking, law enforcement typically does not go after sources. To my knowledge, I can't say definitively that that doesn't happen. I have not encountered that before.
Well, for example, President Obama deported millions of people. Are we assuming this is unique to the Trump administration or not?
Well, so I want to be clear. As you're saying, President Obama deported millions of people. Arresting people and deporting them is not something that's unique to the Trump administration. And in fact, even though the numbers have picked up somewhat, they're still not at the level they were under the beginning of the Obama administration. So let's just be clear about that. What is unusual in this case is the fact that the newspaper may have been involved in some way in ICE's decision to go after this gentleman. And so apparently, as you said, an ICE agent actually mentioned the newspaper as they were arresting this individual, according to him. So that's something that, of course, is very troubling for us.
How did you react when you heard about this arrest?
It was very, very upsetting. Very upsetting. Not because ICE doesn't have the ability to pick up people who are illegally here. Of course they do. But as a reporter, you never want to feel like someone is being penalized for talking to you. Our role is to provide information. It's not to endanger any of our sources. For instance, people who have received DACA, young people who are here.
These are childhood arrivals.
Childhood arrivals, typically brought here by their parents. They don't often talk about the fact that they're DACA recipients, and so you might not realize that they're at school with you, that they might be a fellow employee. You know, there are lawyers, students, tech workers. They're in all sorts of places you might not realize. So they have felt it's very important to get their story out. Are there risks in doing so? Yes, there are. And people need to be aware of those risks, just as they need to be aware of the benefits of making the broader public aware of who these people are.
Have you tried to speak to your source, the man who was arrested?
I have spoken to him. Yeah.
What did you say to one another?
Well, he described to me what the agents said to him when they arrested him. We went over it very carefully. I was working with one of my colleagues who speaks Spanish to make sure that we understood this, which we reported. He certainly didn't seem to blame me or the paper, but he, of course, was worried about his situation. He was worried about his girlfriend who's back in Mexico. He continued to be the source of financial support for his family, his girlfriend and his children. So he was worried about that. They were worried. We later talked to his girlfriend in Mexico. She was, very upset, of course, about that as well. So, and then, of course, we talked about the risks and benefits of continuing to report the story and asked him if he wanted to go ahead with it, and he did.
He didn't blame you, but you said you felt sick. I mean, did he try to put you at ease? Did you have a conversation about that?
No, it's not his responsibility to put me at ease. I'm concentrating on his situation and continuing to report the story. Again, it's always very troubling when somebody might be endangered because of what we wrote or because somebody talked to us. That's not the way you ever want to feel. At the same time, you want to get a story out. You want to let people know whatever government tactics might be involved, who's being affected. That's part of our job. And so we talked about that carefully.
Why does an undocumented immigrant say anything besides no comment to a reporter, given possible risks?
Well, I think for the same reason that I was talking to you about DACA recipients, I think they want to tell people who they are. You know, in this case, as we talked about the last time I came here, we're dealing with people in Pacific County, which is in Southwest Washington, an area of the state that revolves largely around the shellfish industry, and that industry is dependent on immigrant workers, both living legally here and illegally here. And so this gentleman, like many of the people there, had been living there for years and years. So he had been in Pacific County for like 15 years. Many of the people who are there, some of whom are now being detained, were key employees, were heads of their crew. Their employers really depended on them and feel like if these workers go, that their industry may be at risk as well. So I can't speak for why they want to get their stories out, but I imagine that they want to let people know who they are.
Has this been national news, international news?
There has been enormous interest in this story, and especially in Mexico, which has been interesting. So I know of at least three or four newspapers that ran a story about his arrest and possible retaliation. I know Univision and another Mexican TV station also ran stories. A lot of interest, and I think there's obvious concern among Mexicans, both living in Mexico and here, about what this might mean, about talking to the press, about the relationship between the U.S. and Mexico. I think it's being seen as one further point of tension between the two countries at a time when there is already quite a bit of tension.
Do you think this will change your immigration reporting going forward?
I don't know that it will. I think, again, those risks and benefits are there. And I think there are still very, very important stories to tell about what's going on in terms of immigration and in terms of immigration enforcement.
We've been talking with Nina Shapiro, reporter at the Seattle Times. Last month, she wrote a story about deportations in Pacific County. Last week, ICE arrested one of the men featured in the story. They told him they were arresting him because he had been in the newspaper. Nina Shapiro, thank you for coming back and telling us more of the story.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you for listening to The Record. I spoke earlier this hour with Laura Kipnis and Ijeoma Oluo, and a listener, Lori, emailed us to say thanks for having Laura Kipnis on. Quote, I'm so tired of the attitude that women need to be rescued, and I'm tired of people telling me I'm being harassed when I don't feel harassed. Maybe it's my background in martial arts, but I'm completely able to shrug off body talk and deny advances without feeling harassed. All aggressive and unwanted behavior directed at me has resulted in my shutting it down immediately, not waiting 30 years while other women are possibly victimized. And we heard this from David about women standing up to physical threats. David says that is a very middle-class point of view. What chance does an undocumented woman have when her employer or coyote demands sexual favors? What chance does a Native American woman have? What chance do black women have? Good on everyone for beginning to deal with this, but let's get serious and expand the discussion to talk about poverty and the violent sexual exploitation and domination of women of color. Thank you, David and Lori, and we'd love to hear from you by email, record@kuow.org, voicemail 206-543-5869. We're on Twitter and Facebook, and that's all for today. Our show's put together by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jimma Brempong, Bon Huberman, Jason Pagano, Jeannie Yandel, and I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for listening.